Cyber attacks on Australian government agencies, business and institutions are increasing. And while Prime Minister Scott Morrison won't say it directly, it's clear Canberra believes China is responsible. The PM's public warnings about the attacks have been widely read as a message that everyone needs to be better prepared. The opportunities presented by the threat have clearly piqued the interest of his predecessor, Malcolm Turnbull, who today joined the board of directors of cybersecurity firm Casada. I spoke to Malcolm Turnbull a short time ago and asked him why he decided to make cybersecurity a business priority.
I have a very keen interest in Australian innovation and technology and cybersecurity in particular. Casada is making the internet safe for humans. It's founded by Sam Crowther, a young Australian who was working in the Australian Signals Directorate while he was a schoolboy in Canberra, a brilliant young cyber scientist. And this company is able to protect servers, protect governments, protect companies from automated bots, the sort of robots that crawl over the internet and obviously access information, commercial information, but also spread malicious malware that can cause so many problems. So it's a great example. It embodies, if you like, the innovation of the National Innovation and Science Agenda of my government in 2015, and our cybersecurity strategy, which was the first Australian national cybersecurity strategy, which was again a key part of my economic and security policy. So I'm delighted to be working with Sam and his team, and look forward, as I said, to helping make the internet safe for humans.
You're also investing in a Silicon Valley startup which uses AI to identify and block malicious online content. Is there an opportunity for Australian media here, given courts have found them liable for comments posted alongside stories?
Well, yes, absolutely. It could be. Centropy is the name of that company, started by a great team in Silicon Valley. John Redgrave is the principal, ex-Palantir. And it's seeking to grapple with this problem of just a deluge, a torrent of hate speech that is very hard to manage other than by using artificial intelligence of one kind or another. I mean, it's very interesting in terms of this question of speech, Patricia. You know, Americans in particular talk about freedom of speech and the First Amendment, and they hold that freedom, as they should, very dear. But the vicious and venomous attacks online nowadays, the vicious pylons that people experience, some of it from bots, some of it just people being appalling, actually intimidate a lot of speech. A friend of mine who works in the tech sector and has quite a big public profile has said he's never felt less free to speak in America today than ever because of this. So, you know, it's one of the things we're going to have to grapple with is how do we make discourse and speech on the internet more civil? You know, we can disagree, profoundly, but does the discourse have to be so vicious and often violent and menacing?
We've seen Twitter in particular moving much more aggressively to remove or highlight false and misleading content on its platform. In fact, we've seen it even in relation to Donald Trump. What do you make of that move?
The reality is that the platform owners, Twitter in this case, Facebook for another, have got the right to manage the content on their platform. How much they choose to do so, of course, is an important issue because it affects the perception, people's free speech and the perception that free speech is free, but there's got to be some boundaries. I mean, in every free society, there are, even in the United States, there are limits. And when you've got posts that are just utterly false, misleading, in breach of copyright or whatever, then the platform owner is entitled to take them down or qualify them or contextualise them.
We talked on Friday very extensively about something that the Prime Minister announced. The Prime Minister on Friday revealing there's been a big increase in cyber attacks against Australian businesses and institution governments too, and all but named China as the culprit. What did you make of that?
Well, he didn't name China per se, but most people would assume that, cyber attacks of that scale have emanated from China. I mean, China has the, as I say in my book, a bigger picture, the you know, we've got to be realistic about this, that China has the largest cyber espionage operations in the world. They operate at industrial scale. They don't particularly care if they get caught, so they can be very brazen. But we shouldn't be sort of shocked and horrified by this. It's a little bit like, you don't want to be like the policeman that goes into Rick's bar in Casablanca and says, "I'm shocked to discover that there is gambling going on in this bar." We know all countries engage in foreign intelligence gathering and espionage, but the level, the scale of the cyber activities from China are, you know, really of an industrial level is the only way I can describe it, of a scale that we haven't ever seen before.
Australia doesn't usually publicly name the countries responsible for cyber attacks against us, right?
Yeah, but... there's a good reason for that, Patricia. It's not just because, again, you can never be completely, well, actually, you can often be 99% certain, but it is possible to route attacks from other places, you know, and everyone, I guess, is familiar with virtual private networks, so at a very simple level, but there are lots of other more sophisticated methods. And so it's very easy for people, for adversaries who are targeting you on the internet, to be able to do so in a reasonably deniable way. That there wouldn't be too many people in the internet world or the signals intelligence world anyway that would have too many doubts about where this attack has come from.
Is there a benefit to naming where the attack has come from at some point? I know you've explained, but at some point, do you think the government might have to?
Well, I think it is I think it is very valuable to do so, but you've got to A, make sure that you're, you know, 100% right. But obviously, the managing the China relationship is a complex one, and governments and particularly prime ministers may choose to be more circumspect in public but more blunt in private. That's certainly what I used to do, and I think that you've got, you know, it's a complicated relationship, and you've got to handle it skillfully.
Well, our relationship with China has been rocky for some time, but do you see this recent increase in tensions as something new? Has there been a significant shift now?
I think what you're seeing, Patricia, is a series of overreactions from Beijing, which are quite counterproductive. I mean, the opportunity for the Chinese Communist Party right now is to be, what they should be doing, in my view, is to be as unlike President Trump as they can be. So where he is bellicose, where he is inconsistent, where he is erratic, where he is sending off incendiary tweets, they should be quite the reverse. They should be consistent. They should not overreact. They should be as calm and as measured as they can be, because that, frankly, if their object is to win support and trust of other countries, and particularly from countries that are normally closer to the US, then that the steadier and calmer they are, the better. But I think what the government in Beijing is doing is playing to its domestic audience at the moment. So these, they're Chinese people see President Trump fulminating and, you know, carrying on about China and attacking China and the Communist Party. And so they expect the leaders there feel they have to respond in kind. But it honestly doesn't help. I mean, the Ambassador Cheng's has now twice, once while I was PM and now while Scott's PM, has threatened Australia with trade consequences because the government was either saying or doing something he didn't like.
Some of the things we're seeing in terms of trade consequences, is that how you see them? We've been told they're unrelated, but do you see them as direct consequences?
So sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't. I mean, let me put it this way. There's a lot of talk about coal. Australia cannot expect to continue to sell coal, particularly thermal coal, to China in the quantities it has. I mean, China is trying to reduce its use of coal, number one. It's a huge producer of coal. It's improved its own infrastructure. And so as it reduces its overall use of consumption of coal, the coal it will stop using first will obviously be imports, because it wants to maintain and manage employment in their own industries. So, you know, there's a lot of complexity there. But look, the bottom line is we don't have to speculate about it. We've had Chinese government officials, including their own ambassador in Australia, say bluntly there will be trade consequences for Australia if we, you know, say things or do things that displease the leadership in Beijing. And that is just bullying and threats, and it is utterly counterproductive. It may read well in Beijing, but it absolutely plays into the hands of China's critics in Australia and around the world. It's completely misconceived.
You've been an outspoken critic of sexual harassment and domestic violence. Were you shocked by the results of the High Court's investigation into former Justice Dyson Heydon?
Yes, I was. I was absolutely shocked. Yes, I certainly was.
The law as a profession is very old, very hierarchical, as you know, male-dominated at the top. How common is sexual harassment, and do you think enough has been done to tackle it broadly? I mean, the fact that it happened in the highest court in this country.
Patricia, there's no way you can describe this as other than shocking and appalling. You say the law is male-dominated. I think that's true in the sense that there are more men in high legal positions than women, but we do have a woman as Chief Justice, Susan Kiefel, whom I appointed when I was Prime Minister, and I think it's great to see the way she has, and the court has, taken responsibility for these complaints. They've had it carefully investigated, appointed an independent person to inquire into it, and made the appropriate apologies to the women who were affected. But really, you know, the key here, this is about power. This is about men abusing their power over women. We must have zero tolerance for it. We have to have respect for workplaces. That's why I introduced the ministerial code of conduct, to introduce the so-called bonk ban, to say that ministers should not have sexual relations with people that work for them, for members of their staff. I mean, we've got to have workplaces where women are respected, and where this, you know, this kind of thing, just there is no place for it. I can't be more emphatic than that. It is literally, it is something, a phenomenon, a practice, a conduct for which we must have zero tolerance.
Let's talk about universities, because the government's made this announcement about the different costs to different degrees, and the cost of studying humanities at university is set to double. Oh, I was a humanities student. But job-relevant course fees will be reduced under that overhaul. Do you think that's a wise decision?
I'm all in favour of encouraging people to do more quantitative subjects, you know, to do more maths, to do engineering, to do science, or at least to do units, quantitative units in their degrees. Look, I, to be honest, I can't see the rationale for increasing, you know, doubling the cost of humanities degrees. Look, I would say the only part of this that I've got a little sympathy for is the effort to discourage people from doing law. And I say this as a lawyer, former lawyer, I suppose. Still, I guess I'm still a lawyer. But the, you know, a lot of young people get good marks in the HSC and then decide to do law without any intention of practicing law. And I, you know, my advice for decades has been to young people, if you want to be a lawyer, do law, but don't do law because you think it's an interesting sort of background degree. If you want something that's going to provide you with some sort of intellectual enrichment, there are a lot of other things you can do, including maths and economics and literature and languages and history and so forth. So the only aspect to this that I've got a little sympathy with is the trying to discourage people from doing law unless they really want to practice law.
But history degrees?
Well, history, you know, if you overlook the lessons of history, you're just doomed to repeat the mistakes that have been made in the past. You know, I studied history at university, particularly loved medieval history, I must say. Yeah, I just don't understand the rationale for it. I think it's baffling. I've got a point about law, but apart from that, I find the changes very puzzling. I certainly would encourage people to do quantitative subjects. I mean, I always, you know, one of the things that Simon Birmingham and I were seeking to do when I was PM and he was Education Minister was to make maths once again compulsory for people, you know, if they want to matriculate to university. It's as it was in my day. You know, we are short on quantitative skills, which is bizarre because, you know, quite frankly, the economy is a digital economy and digital literacy is more important every year. And so with fewer people doing computer science than used to be the case, and certainly many fewer women doing it, we've got a market failure there.
Let me just ask you a question. I'm about to speak to Bill Shorten, actually, another former leader. But just on this issue of robo-debt, you were the Prime Minister that brought in so-called robo-debt. It's been deemed illegal. The government's paying back all of the money that it called for. Do you regret introducing robo-debt?
Yes, I certainly do regret that it's the way it worked out. I mean, it was you know, it came up to cabinets, you know, through the relevant ministers and departments. It was income matching has been around for quite a long time, but this was clearly not handled well at all.
Did you seek legal advice at the time? Because clearly the income matching was illegal.
I was the Prime Minister, Patricia. I mean, I assume the ministers, you know, cabinet ministers present submissions that have, you know, gone through their departmental processes and so forth. You assume all of those things have been dealt with.
Do you apologise to Australians? I mean, the Prime Minister, current Prime Minister, has been asked this too, but the people who clearly...
Well, I'm very sorry it's had the created the, you know, dismay and distress that it has. But again, it's not a... Income matching was not new. But the way this system was designed, and I think in particular implemented, left a lot to be desired. It failed, and it obviously had serious issues of you know, legal validity. So yes, I'm very sorry that you know worked out the way it did. But it's important, obviously, to make sure that social welfare benefits go to those who are entitled to them. We're living in a world of scarce resources, but governments have got to operate within the law, and they've got to recognise always that we're dealing with, you know, people. We're dealing with, you know, fellow Australians. We're not just dealing in a world of numbers.